slide, please?
It could be really important.
That'd be fine, Tom.
It came back to something like, in the dinner I just cooked for you, isn't?
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order and open up a work session on House Bill 3041. We did get permission from the Speaker to rescind the subsequent referral. So we'll take a motion on that, and then we'll send it on its way.
The whole thing. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the HB 3041-1 amendment dated April 8, 2009.
Representative Harker moves to adopt the 3041-1 amendments dated April 8, 2009. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I then move HB 3041 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral be to the Committee on Ways and Means, that the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Harker moves House Bill 3041 as amended with the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? You all remember this is the literacy bill for Head Start. Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembrough?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Panemar?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Excuse, but we'll give him a chance to vote when he comes back.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. We'll ask Representative Van Moorman to carry it on the floor. And we will close the work session on House Bill 3041. Do we have all the sheets here?
2009.
No, all the sheets on the witness sheets. In case you hadn't noticed, we're at ease. For just a moment. No. House Bill 3230. Seeing no witnesses, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3230. What else do we have?
We have 3204.
3204. 3204. No, we have 3209. Is that a number?
No.
3204, I'm sorry. No, 2019, that's what I'm looking for. Thank you. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2019 and ask Lynn Marie Kreider. Haven't seen you today. I mean, haven't seen you for a while. Come and join us. Welcome. And Laura Etherton as well, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ready? My name is Lynn Marie Kreider, and I direct research and public policy programs of Service Employees International Union Local 49. SEIU Local 49 represents 7,000 janitors and healthcare workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington. House Bill 2019 will bring transparency and equity to the pricing of hospital services and will create incentives for hospitals to perform efficiently and to pass their savings on to consumers. We support the bill. House Bill 2019 actually does two simple but perhaps revolutionary things. First, it shines a light on hospital prices by requiring hospitals to report their prices for hospital services to the Department of Human Services. That's page 1, lines 10 and 11. Secondly, it brings equity to hospital pricing by requiring hospitals to charge the same prices to all non-governmental payers. That's page 1, lines 12 to 14. As I'm sure all of you know, the real price paid for hospital services is set in a variety of ways, but the bottom line is the same. What you pay depends on who you are. Medicare sets rates for hospitals at levels the program believes are adequate to cover the costs of an efficient hospital, that an efficient hospital would incur to provide services, including an allowance for profit. OHP Medicaid also sets rates. Health plans pay rates negotiated with the hospital or hospital system, and those rates vary dramatically by plan and by hospital. Hospitals with local monopolies can drive prices higher than those that must compete. Hospitals that are part of hospital systems that can force purchasers to accept high prices at some hospitals in order to get access to others can drive prices higher than independents. And plans with large market share can get lower prices if, but only if, they're able and willing to exclude hospitals from their networks that charge prices that are too high. SEIU studies based on publicly reported data show that urban hospitals in Oregon collect anywhere from 113% to 256% of their costs. Very different pricing situations depending on the power relationships at play. And you'll see attached to my testimony figure one, which lists all of the hospitals in the state. And the center column of numbers is the amount above the hospital's cost, or excuse me, the percentage of cost which is charged to the uninsured, the full gross charge. So for the first hospital there on the line, Adventist Medical Center, 302% of cost. And then the last column is what, on average, a insurance company in the state pays to that particular hospital. You'll see when you spend a little time with it, you'll see how varied those prices are. And, of course, it's the uninsured and the insurers without contracts with a hospital that pay those full-bore prices in the center column. Prices vary a lot by hospital, and the Office of Health Policy and Research and the Department of Consumer and Business Services have just released their 2007 data showing the average after-discount price charged for inpatient services to health plan enrollees. And SEIU has aggregated the data that is reported on a diagnostic-related group basis to get an index, a sort of priciness index for hospitals. And we show you that comparison on figure 3 attached to my testimony. And again, I'm not going to go through that, but what you'll see is a wide variation in price by hospital around the state. In fact, we found that the highest priced hospital was about 41% more expensive than the lowest priced hospital. average price variation. But what you're seeing in Figure 3 is average prices. So that's a mix. If every hospital in the state had the same mix of services that it was providing, what would their comparative price be for that bundle of services? But in fact, some hospitals are high priced for some services and lower priced for other services. And so in Figure 4, you'll see an example where we looked at a set of clusters of services, so respiratory system services, pregnancy and childbirth, alcohol and drug services. And this chart just shows Portland area hospitals and compares, depending on what kind of services you're looking at, what hospitals are high and low. What I'm saying to you is simply hospitals charge very different prices to depending on the service and depending on who you are, and prices have very little to do with the underlying cost of services. What this bill then does in a crazy system is to bring equity to the pricing situation by requiring hospitals to charge all private payers the same rate. It eliminates the expensive process by which hospitals and insurance companies negotiate rates. It should save money in the system as a whole by eliminating that negotiation process. The bill does allow hospitals to set their own rates. It doesn't regulate them, but it does make their rates public. And it should enable consumers and payers to steer their business toward lower-priced hospitals where alternatives are available. By doing that, the bill will help efficient and low-priced independent community hospitals get business from price-conscious consumers and payers despite their lack of power in today's market. The bill doesn't eliminate the disconnect between the cost of providing hospital services and the prices charged for them, but it should change the incentives under which hospitals insurance companies now operate in some very important ways that I think eventually will transform prices and bring them down. First, it will reduce the incentive that now exists for hospitals to locate their facilities and market their services in order to optimize their payer mix, to avoid low-income people that aren't going to be able to pay that bill, and to drive their marketing and their business toward the privately insured. Second, it will increase the incentive for hospitals to focus on being more efficient and passing their savings on to consumers and payers. And third, it should encourage...
May I interrupt?
Sure.
How is it going to make them more efficient? I mean, how would you envision efficiency?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I think there's a general consensus that hospitals don't now operate particularly efficiently. And what this does, by making it very clear to folks in our state what is being charged actually,
why are they not efficient?
I think, Representative Maurer, that they're not efficient for a couple of reasons. One is there's very little competition in the market, so they don't have to be efficient. I think that in Oregon, it's a surprise to people that when DCBS and Uper started putting out some information about relative cost, and the paper started picking some of that up, that was a surprise to people. We had no idea that some hospitals are charging twice what others. So I think it's partly that there's no reason they have to be. And we know, however, that in most of the rest of the world, hospital services, physician services, et cetera, are less expensive than they are here. I have to believe, although I'm not an expert.
Hospital services are less expensive other places than they are here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I believe that's true. We know that the cost, the spending for health care is much higher in this country than it is elsewhere. We also know, of course, that we get no more services here than folks do in the rest of the world. So, no, I'm not comparing Oregon to someplace else, but rather the country.
Okay. Follow up to that. How come Oregon price point doesn't get us pretty darn close to where you want to be?
Several reasons. Oregon price point, which is the Hospital Association's website, provides information, as I recall, about the charge for services on average. And as I've noted in my testimony, the charge is sort of like the sticker price on a car. It really bears little relationship to what's actually paid. So Medicare sets its rate, Medicaid sets its rate, and insurers negotiate discounts, which are in the neighborhood of 60-70% of the charge. So I think this bill, by requiring that everybody charge the same thing, stops the games and says there's one price, and I hope, would create more incentive for efficiency.
I guess I'd like to just follow on, because I'm having a little, I think I understand the proposal, having a little trouble understanding the mechanism by which it would ratchet down costs. Right now, hospitals have a charge, this mythical charge, and some people pay that charge, or some people pay something less, and they negotiate with regions or other places for, usually at some discount off that charge, 20%, 30%, 40%. ODS tells me it's 5%, I mean, some number. Why would they want to negotiate any of those prices? Why don't they just say our charge is what it is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, absolutely. It does do away with the negotiation, but I think the negotiation has to be in the hospital's head. Can we actually get business if we set our price to everybody at this level?
Well, if Regents is going to pay whatever, I mean, unless Regents is going to say to its people, well, you can't go to Providence St. Vincent, or you can't go to Emmanuel, or you can't go to Meridian Park, then they're just going to end up paying the higher bill, and it's going to raise the price of health insurance, it seems to me.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you that unless payers are going to become sensitive to price and be willing to say, if your price is that, I'm not going to take my business to your hospital, then this alone doesn't do it. And my personal preference is for a system that has a publicly accountable entity setting the prices rather than the hospital itself. But I do think that transparency and equity are the beginning.
Okay. Why don't you finish your testimony?
Just a couple of comments. I think that this bill does encourage insurers to begin looking at hospital efficiency rather than just saying, well, if my competition is paying the high rate, I'm willing to do that too. I also want to note that I think this is the kind of thing that can be done with very little infrastructure on the part of the state. The bill requires DHS to prescribe a format for reporting the price, and it does allow DHS to assess civil penalties for violation of the rule that you charge everyone the same price. But I think if this legislature passes a law, we can count on hospitals to follow that rule. Therefore, I think we can do this with essentially no impact on the DHS budget, and I would encourage the committee to take this step along the path to a more efficient system and to send the bill to the floor with a do pass recommendation or roll it into House Bill 2009. Thank you.
Specific?
Any further questions?
I'm Laura Atherton. I'm an advocate with OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's great to be here today to offer our support for this bill, 2019, that you're considering today for two reasons. One, we all know healthcare costs way too much. This whole system is broken, and it is rare that the system works at all like a market. To the extent that it can work like a market, we'd like to maximize that as much as possible. I think a couple of things that are included in this bill help to move us in that direction. One is a pint of coconut milk should cost a pint of coconut milk. It should a Big Mac at McDonald's should cost the same thing for everybody. We've got a market where people don't know how much what they're buying costs. And to the extent that they can know how much what they're buying costs, that's good. Let's have transparency on the actual cost, not just on the as you say, the mythical charges, but what are the actual rates? What are people paying? The second piece is having that rate apply to everybody, whether you are insured and your insurer is willing to pay, has negotiated a cheaper price, or whether you're uninsured and, in fact, are probably the least able to pay. Those prices should really be the same across the board. It should cost the same roughly for everyone. Now, at the same time, I know that we're trying to see where are areas that we can negotiate better prices and negotiate better value, and I think that will be something that we figure out as we go forward, mainly in the areas of prescription drugs and in the area of health insurance. But when it comes to the actual hospital services, the equity and transparency really are critical pieces to help this work to the extent it can more like a market as this committee and this whole body works toward broad health reform in many areas. The other piece, I think, there's the one, having the market work better so that to the extent that Oregonians can shop around a little bit before they go to the hospital, can look at how much does this service cost here versus here, they can do that, and it also helps health researchers to really be able to examine what are the areas where we really are seeing costs that don't quite make sense, and why is that? And it helps the hospitals have that information, too. So we support the bill. I think it's moving us in the right direction on transparency and equity on price. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just have one more question. Under this bill, I assume if a hospital's establish a rate and Medicare or Medicaid wants to pay less than that rate, then the hospital just wouldn't be able to accept those payments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the definition of healthcare purchasers who must all be charged the same rate excludes government entities. That's
why.
Six.
Why? I mean, to me, that makes this policy completely unworkable. Because you have, you look at a Three Rivers Community Hospital in my district, when you have 60% of their payers are government. And so it completely negates the reason for any sort of competition, because the government, they set the, there's no way that the commercial insurance truly really helped make the difference. It just doesn't, you have to include government in this.
Mr.
And I'd say Medicaid and Medicare better step up to the plate and pay the bill. Currently they don't.
Mr.
They could
Chair,
pay what they pay and everybody else would have to pay that, right?
Mr. Chair,
now that might get efficiency.
Yeah, that'd be called efficiency would be close the doors.
Maybe. Figure out how to be more efficient.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Well, I mean, for example, it turns out Toyota's figured out how to be more efficient. GM isn't, so GM's
going away? And
no, it's not.
Toyota
it's called
is.
Government Motors, and this Fed stepped in and bailed them out.
Not yet. We'll see.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I think that the bill excludes government entities because we, of course, can't, without the permission of the feds, change the Medicare rate. I agree with you that this, a system of equity would work better if it covered all those programs, and we certainly wouldn't have any problem with your trying to figure out how to include Medicaid in this program. I don't know whether within our budget constraints that can be done right now, but in principle, I'm not in disagreement with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close public hearing on House Bill 2019, and we don't have a fiscal on. Well, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3228. Do we have a list on that one?
We do.
You want to describe the bill? I keep forgetting to ask you to do that.
This bill requires that Department of Human Services implement programs for training and certification of certain teachers, counselors, health assistants to apply fluoride varnishes to children's teeth. The DHS with the Oregon Board of Dentistry will adopt rules to implement the program to serve elementary schools, pre-kindergartens, Head Start programs, and the women's, infant, and children programs. And then there's some minimum rules required. We received a dash one amendment on this today. It basically replaces the entire bill. I didn't have time to do an engrossed version of it, but like I say, it basically replaces the entire bill, and you have that amendment in front of you. It's the dash one to 3228. And I believe that Representative Kotek is this your bill, Representative Kotek?
Which is not.
Okay. Well,
I am fully supportive of this bill. It's a committee bill.
Let's get Hoffman. Do you want to tell us about it, or would it be somebody else? 3-2-3. Well, let's
Here's
get a couple up. Let's
not
get
far away.
Carrie Phillips up. Karen Phillips up as well, please. And maybe April. Could that be Love?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, it is L O V E.
Dr. Love. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman, and I represent the Oregon Dental Association. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3228. So thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on this bill. What I'm handing out is a copy of the 2007 Oregon SMILE survey that was conducted by the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services, and that has a lot of information about the growing epidemic that we have in Oregon regarding tooth decay in children. Tooth decay is the most common childhood disease that we have in Oregon, affecting 5 times more children than asthma. Tooth decay among children is a major concern for a number of reasons, often causing oral pain and infection, which in turn can affect a child's school attendance and success, nutrition, self-esteem, and general health. Recognizing and treating dental decay in children is important so they can live healthy lives now. In addition to, it is commonly recognized that untreated tooth decay worsens with age and eventually affects a person's overall general health. For many years, the Oregon Dental Association, as I'm sure many of you on this committee are aware, have worked very, very hard to try to pass community water fluoridation. Portland, Oregon is currently the largest city in the United States that does not fluoridate their water. Our dentists working in fluoridated areas like Beaverton and Salem can see the difference in those children's teeth. They are much healthier populations of people because they are getting preventive oral health care that they desperately need. For this reason, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, recommends that the best way to provide that preventive health care, oral health care to people, is through community water fluoridation. However, since it has not been the will of the legislature to implement this policy in Oregon, the Oregon Dental Association came together over the interim to put together a school-based fluoride treatment program. To quote the SMILE survey that you have in front of you, for communities without community water fluoridation, participation in school-based supplement programs is the next recommendation. So we have tried to draft a bill that reflects that. Why the dash ones? The economic situation we now find ourselves in has changed dramatically from when we came together over the interim to put together the bill. So how do we provide preventive oral health care in a school-based treatment program without placing additional burden on our school systems and the Department of Human Services? We decided, and it is reflected in the dash one amendments before you today, to establish a grant program in the Department of Human Services Public Health Division. Into this fund can be deposited state, federal, and private dollars so that school districts can apply to the Department of Human Services for grants to provide preventive oral health care to their student populations. Each year, the Oregon Dental Association Foundation, the Oregon Education Association Foundation, and the ODS companies provide nearly $500,000 in preventive oral health care to our kids through our tooth taxi. This is a great program, but it only allows us to reach a very limited amount of kids. We're doing everything that we can. We have to continue to build on that. We have to do everything in our power to provide sound preventive oral health care for our kids to help combat this growing epidemic. For that reason, we urge your support of House Bill 3228 as amended by the dash ones. Again, I very, very much appreciate your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And we don't have a fiscal yet on the dash ones, but the sense is that would sort of take most of the fiscal away. Is that the intention?
Chair?
Yes.
I'm just curious about what's currently in place. When I was a student in Portland Public Schools, I had fluoride varnish every couple months it seemed like they did it. Is that no longer being done?
It depends where you live. The Division of Oral Health does have a program where they can provide preventive health care. It's my understanding that that's mostly concentrated in the Portland area. And so what we're trying to do is utilize that school-based program, that model program, to get into areas where we know we have seen the most amount of decay, to provide preventive care there, and then work our way out so that we are eventually providing preventive health care to every child in the state of Oregon. One of the reasons that community water fluoridation is very important is that it reaches everybody, regardless of whether or not you go to school. Ideally, we would be providing this kind of preventive care to kids by the time that they're one, but in lieu of a community water fluoridation implementation, this is the next best step to target kids both in health Head Start programs and in elementary schools. Get to them as early as possible.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Do we, I call Karen Phillips and...
Karen Phillips didn't know that when you sign up there, that means she has to talk in front of you guys.
Oh, okay. So
I unfortunately remember that, so from
does
the last
that mean
time.
Karen Phillips doesn't want to talk to us?
She sent
great.
The letter.
Okay, excellent.
And she's
thank
for
you.
This, so...
That's easy.
My name is April Love. I'm a volunteer dentist, a private dentist. And I wanted to just reiterate what Margie was talking about. I do a lot of volunteer work screening Head Start kids, and I'd say 40 to 60% of our Head Start kids have cavities, which is about twice the national average. Of those kids, about 10% have really rotten teeth, and of those, probably half of them have to go to the hospital. And this is costing DHS, the state, it's costing $5,000 to $10,000 for every kid that has to go to the hospital. Plus, they have to have general anesthesia. But since you guys actually passed the bill 2 years ago, thank you very much. This is kind of the good news, and that is the OCDC Head Start that serves 4,000 kids. 60% of them have had...
OCDC,
Oregon Childhood Development Coalition. But that's one of the biggest providers of Head Start services. They have 4,000 kids. 60% of them, of those 4,000 kids, got their varnish through Head Start. The other 40% through dentists. We were working with And then the Mount Hood Head Start in Multnomah County, they serve 800 kids, and last fall we varnished all 800 of them, and with the health assistance, and now they're varnishing for the second time with the Head Start health assistance working with the Mount Hood nursing students. The good news is, and this is really good news, Karen Ayers is the health specialist of the OCDC Head Start, and I talked to her this morning, and she said, we've been working on this program for 3 years, that she's hardly any of her kids now have to go to the hospital. That might not seem like a big deal to you, but it's a really big deal, and it's extremely cost savings. And she's seeing just a generalized decrease in the amount of decay that we're seeing. The varnish is a little different. Representative Garrett, the program you had probably was a fluoride rinse treatment that they had. This is different. This is a much higher concentration of fluoride. It works a lot better. We feel that if we can get it on kids' teeth twice a year, it'll reduce their decay by half.
And it's a relatively simple process.
Oh, God,
right?
It's 15 seconds.
We heard that in the hearings last
30 seconds in a tough kid and 15 seconds on a really good kid. It's just amazingly, amazingly fast.
Could even be done, I know it's hard to imagine, by a principal.
I don't know whether that's
rumored,
not exactly
right?
Legal, but I mean, can be done. I can't tell you what I do. So, but Karen has developed a really great training program. She has a dynamite PowerPoint, but her philosophy, and this is actually the philosophy of a training program, you get the whole family on board. She just does a lot of training with families through their health assistants because it's got to be a family thing. And then we have the varnish. She also has worked on their own nutrition program in the Head Starts where they don't give a lot of bad stuff. One of the parts of the program is, and this is one of the most effective things we do, the sugar bags. This is how much sugar is in gummy bears, and all the kids just love those gummy bears, and everyone cringes when they see the sugar, which is now all over your desk, and you're probably going to get ants.
At least the desk won't get cavities.
I know. No, it's sugar. It's not varnish. And then we have a lot of handouts we give parents. She's got a book that's called How to Have Healthy Teeth, which costs $5.50. We've been distributing this. This is $3.60, but it's really cool. It's really a good one for little kids. This is what we use for the older kids. Because it's dramatic, it looks ugly, you know, we talk about smoking too. So the programs are in place. My PCC dental hygiene students are now going to nursing schools, and also the Pacific University hygiene students are going out. Both of these schools worked with me on the varnish programs, and now they're going independently into the Head Start programs. So the dental hygiene students have been very effective. But the coolest thing is actually we're actually seeing the results of this. We're just getting less decay. So, but the training program isn't so much the problem. I mean, we need to have money for the handout materials. We need to have money for maybe an official trainer. Right now, the training and everything that's being done is by a couple compulsive anti-cavity people. And you can't depend on a sustainable program based on a couple nuts. So, the biggest problem, though,
the legislature gets a little
problem. But the biggest problem, the reason I show this is that this is, WIC sees kids before we do. We have not made any inroads into WIC at all, and this is one of the things that are in their program. This apple juice has exactly the same amount of sugar as soda and has a pH of 2. It's very acidic. So we really need to get WIC on board, and we can't do that without the training. We can't do that without somebody paying for the varnish. I think the money can come from the number of kids who don't have to go to the hospital that should be able to actually pay for the program.
Okay.
Any questions?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we're not asking for money in this bill. We're asking for a place to put money.
Yes. Then we
fine.
Actually
thank you very much. Thank you for your good work. That's great. We really.
Sorry for the mess.
Just sweep it on the floor, though.
I know, but I feel bad because you will get ants.
Ms. Bradley,
I have ants in my basement.
Are you here? Oh, there you are, yes.
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry,
while our next testifier is coming up, I was noticing that this is similarly written with the amendments now closely to what 3041 was, which was permissive language for the department to set something up, especially if money can come into it, and which I think is be nice to send another similar.
Oh, 3041 do.
Well, that's the one we just passed up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
I was wondering how last year's bill did.
Of allowing.
We'll ask Ms. Bradley.
More latitude for fluoride varnishes.
Mm-hmm. Welcome again.
Thank you, Chair Greenlink and Committee. For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm the Administrator of the Office of Family Health for the Oregon Public Health Division, and our oral health program is in our office. I'm here today to provide some public health perspective on House Bill 3228, which would provide fluoride varnish to elementary-age children by trained teachers, counselors, and health assistants as it was originally written. I would also really like to thank legislative leadership for their continued efforts into supporting children's oral health and to raise the visibility of this issue, since it's such a significant concern here for Oregon. As the bill was originally written, we actually had some concerns about the intent in terms of the age group, and I just want to do a little bit of clarification, and that's why I gave you a chart that our program put together. As described by Dr. Love, the work that fluoride varnish does in children up to about the age of 5 is absolutely the strongest evidence-based practice, and it's what we are targeting. The challenge is in the elementary school group, and actually the evidence at this time does not indicate that that's the most effective intervention, and so we had some concerns about how this was being approached. We are very interested in the amendments that have been adopted, though, and appreciate and are working with the bill's sponsors on the amendments and can look at those a little bit more closely. But the chart that we've handed out to you talks about fluoride. On one side, the main front, it talks about systemic fluoride, which is the reference, obviously, to community water fluoridation, fluoride tablets, and fluoride drops. If you flip to the back side, which is topical fluoride, and that's the subject of this conversation today, what you'll see here is that with fluoride varnish, which is in the first bar across, it really is best for children, again, up to about the age of 5 or 6 in terms of an evidence-based practice along with a health assessment at that time. These are, you know, this is the changing nature of science. What we want to do is find the best opportunity to do something with our children in terms of the right kind of intervention. So we really are working closely with the dental community in terms of trying to look at the amendments and the directions that they will be moving in. And I just need to make another note. Our WIC program actually is in the process of making changes, not because simply we want them in Oregon, but federally they actually are changing their food package. And fruit juices will be dropped from them as effective as of the 1st of April. And we have been longstanding advocates of that in Oregon, and we're very pleased to see federally that that's going to be changed, because the concerns being raised by Dr. Love are very appropriate in terms of the amount of sugar in fruit juices. So if I can be of any assistance to the
panel? Support the bill as amended with the dash going amendment?
Chair Greenlick, we saw an earlier version that we support the intent. We just saw the final version right now and just need to look at it a little more closely.
Okay. The final version simply means you don't have to do anything except accept money. Spend it if it comes if it happens to fall out of the sky.
Which we appreciate. Part of our concern with what was originally proposed actually addressed the fact that there wasn't any infrastructure around training or certification or for any ability to track varnish. Right now, for example, dental sealants, we actually do know how many children have had dental sealants and have very good information that we can provide back to the legislature, anyone that asked. The current program has got a lot of very strong community work, but not a way for us to really sort of track information.
Okay, great. Are there questions? Yes,
ma'am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. You know, there's so many different ways to get fluoride to right. children. And I know we have a fluoride tablet program, which is listed under the systemic chart because it's ingested. But that's a daily thing. And I'm just wondering, how much do the tablets cost? How successful are we doing the daily ingestion in the schools? Why aren't we serving all the elementary schools? I'm not sure what some of the barriers are there compared to a fluoride varnish, for example, which we could do twice a year. I know the cost of fluoride varnish is not that high. And I get what you're saying about, evidence-based, but I also think because we have such a serious oral health issue in the state, I would at least like to get fluoride varnish on, twice a year onto the kids' teeth versus maybe having a tablet program that is not as successful as it could be. So I just don't know where the tablet program is versus doing varnish.
Chair Greenlink and Representative Kotek, you ask a really great question, and part of the issue that we are all struggling with is limited financing and then the ability that we can work with different community coalitions in terms of moving things forward. We do tend to take a look at what is really the evidence in terms of what is the most effective age group and the greatest target. In our elementary school children, actually what is most effective are dental sealants on the molars. And that's really where our focus has been with elementary school. Now, that's a separate question than fluoride treatments, but it actually is more pertinent to what would be the impact in terms of decreasing tooth decay. And so we tend to take slightly different approaches based on age groups. The tablet program has one that we have not been as extensively involved in because our focus with elementary school has been more driven towards, again, sealants, and that's where we put our focus in our work.
You have a follow-up? But are the dental sealants more expensive? I mean, I understand doing the sealants, and there is evidence behind them, but it's much more labor-intensive. It only probably appropriate for certain types of children with certain types of tooth conditions. I'm just trying to, you know, how many more can we serve versus, you know, prevention versus sealants? That's
Chair Greenlink and Representative Kotek, I'm sorry that I don't have Dr. Gordon Empey with me. So I actually might ask Dr. Love to come up because she might be able to address the dental side of it potentially.
Could we, I wonder whether we could hold this. I'm not sure.
All right. Because I could have.
I can quickly answer it.
Come up and do it.
Yeah, my understanding in terms of the way we've been approaching it, but that's speaking as the program administrator, is that our approach is that all children should have dental sealants. That actually that is the most effective way of addressing cavities in that age group in terms of sealing the molars. But I would defer to Dr. Love and actually Dr. Empey if he was able to come at a later point in time.
Yes, the problem is that we don't have studies of kids who are older, so we're not really sure what varnish does because all the studies have been with little kids. But this amendment does deal with other issues rather than just the varnish. The sealants are great. I mean, they're fabulous, but essentially we're only doing fifth and sixth graders, so we're getting, second and third graders, so we're only getting four teeth out of 32. So that's, it'd be cool if the sealants could be on all the teeth, but they're just on four teeth, but it's a great program. The supplement program, see, there's two kinds of fluoride. We want to get kids to have the systemic fluoride so that it changes the shape of all their permanent teeth, so the advantage to those permanent teeth are for the rest of their lives. The fluoride varnish is just topical. It gets to the teeth that are already in the mouth, so they're kind of different programs. It would be great if every kid in elementary school was taking fluoride supplements in school. We're having a hard time getting teachers on board, but basically 800 school districts qualify for dental programs run by the state because for the free and reduced luncheon, only 400 of them are on board. So about half the kids that could be helped by the state are getting helped. And actually, even if they could get to the other 400, there's just not money there. So they're running out of money for the supplement. So
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson?
I'm getting a little problem understanding the who on this. The original bill says to train teachers, counselors, and health assistants. And then the amendment says training school administrators on techniques of fluoride varnish. It doesn't say doing it, just on the techniques. And then it refers to dental hygienists and whatnot. Number one, I think we're going to have a problem when the teachers find out that in addition to whatever else they've been doing, they're also going to be doing fluoride varnish because teachers are kind of busy. And secondly, the question, is this a technique that would lend itself to having other kinds of community people do it, school volunteers, as long as they had the training? Does this have to be, I can't tell if it has to be a healthcare professional with the amendment or if it's something anybody could do with half a brain and some training.
Chair Greenlink and Representative Thompson, I actually would defer to the originator of the amendment to speak to those issues, since we haven't really had a chance to review the bill.
Yeah.
Are you angling to get pharmacists in this one, too?
No. Even I have my limits.
I have sugar on my hands now. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record again, my name is Margie Hoffman. Our intent with the amendments was to draft it in a way that's flexible so we can work with the individual school districts to find out whether it's best to have, you know, a licensed healthcare professional such as Dr. Love go in and treat the students, or whether it makes more sense to train teachers to treat their own students. So we're trying to maintain flexibility so that in different school districts it can work in different ways, but the bottom line is that we're helping prevent tooth decay in kids.
I'm a big supporter of the concept. I'm just concerned about the delivery, particularly, and I've said it before, rural Oregon.
I think the question is, could you train volunteers?
Yeah, Rome, Oregon isn't going to have a lot of surplus healthcare professionals, nor are they probably going to have teachers who are going to want to do it.
But they do have the principal.
The principal, yeah.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Thompson.
Plenty of time.
You're absolutely correct, and people would be able to be trained to provide this.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you both. I have to hold it over till Tuesday night rather than Wednesday. No, I have to hold it over till Monday. Let's reschedule this for Wednesday, please, and see if we can get a fiscal that goes with that amendment. And if it turns out, if you get the fiscal back relatively quickly, and it turns out this does not need to go to Ways and Means, which I might guess, then we can also try and get the subsequent rescinded if we hear about it. So we will close public hearing on House Bill 3228 and set it over to next Wednesday and see if we can get a fiscal on it. Before I open to 3204, which I'll do next, I do want to talk a little bit about schedule. We're getting toward the end of the time when we have to deal with House bills. Just to be safe, the last day we can pass out House bills is Monday, the 27th of April. I've asked for permission to continue that evening. I don't know if we get it yet. Have you heard anything? Whether we can schedule 6 to 8. I was hoping that we would go 3 to 5, and if we still need time to finish up any of our work, take a dinner break and then come back from 6 to 8 on the 27th. So if you would put that on your calendar. To reward you for that and all the hard work you're doing, I can absolutely tell you to put on your calendar we will not be here that Friday. We'll give you that Friday off, and if things work well, I'll give you Wednesday off as well. We'll know, but...
Paid?
The same, $70 you get for these 2 hours, you would get... No, not that much. What? Nothing like that.
It's less than minimum wage.
Yeah. Mm. But so you can plan. We will definitely close, and you can put that on your schedule. Definitely plan on not being here that Friday. I don't know what day it is.
May 1st,
yeah. May Day. You can go out and dance around a maypole. And if the load looks great, we'll take Wednesday off too, because you have all been working very hard and will continue to be working very hard right up to that deadline. Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3204. We have two amendments, right? You want to talk about that bill for a moment? Margie and...
Dr.
Well, let's get... I was going to hope we could get... I was hoping we could get Margie and Paul Cosgrove up, but let's do it differently. Let's start with Paul Cosgrove and Lisa Rawley, and then after that, immediately, the next panel would be Margie Hoffman and Dr. Asai, is that correct?
Asai.
Pardon me?
Asai.
Asai, great, okay. That'll be the next panel.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes.
May I just say a few comments, since I don't really want to testify, but just briefly.
Oh, please. You want to kick this off? That would be great.
If I could. I don't know if Representative Maurer wants to make any comments.
So yeah, this is your your old bill. How about if you both do take a minute and testify? Would that be okay?
All right. Very brief.
You want to testify from here?
Yeah, this is fine.
You might testify formally from here.
You know what?
The open hearing.
I just want to say, you know, for those of you who weren't on the healthcare committee in 2007 or during the interim, we dealt with a bill regarding limited access. I always forget the LAP, limited access permit, dental hygienist. And I just, one of the reasons I wanted to co-sponsor this bill, and I would be a fan of any oral health bill out there, is that I think we have some huge problems, and I think the SMILE survey shows that. And my biggest interest in this bill is if we have folks coming out of dental hygiene programs who really want to work in the community as LAP dental hygienists, are there barriers we still need to address to get them into the community? I'm also very aware that other dental professionals, the dentists, the doctors, have some concerns about the bill, and I'm hoping we have a robust conversation. I know you've dealt with the scope of practice questionnaires and all that good thing. But I think, just for my colleagues here, I think it's really important to push the envelope as much as we can around mid-level professionals, because we have issues here in the state making sure people have access to care. And I think that's the framing of this bill. Where we come down with all the details remains to be seen, but that's why I'm supporting the bill.
Thank you, Representative Kotek. Representative Maurer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kotek said it very well. I tend to be very supportive of expansions of scope of practice because when you have a shortage of providers in any field and you have regulatory hurdles that have been raised because of some long past oversupply, then you need to revisit those regulatory hurdles. And so this, to me, is about at least opening up the question and asking for the interest groups to weigh in, and we'll see where we end up. But clearly, I hope this is about access. And if it's about turf wars, about protection of a profession to try to protect someone's, you know, little fiefdom, then that probably won't win many friends. But if there's a true concern about training, and those are legitimized, then again, those have validity and need to be taken into account. So I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kotek, Representative Maurer. Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association. I'd like to thank both of those representatives, as well as several others of you who were instrumental in helping us get this bill introduced and the conversation started. The Oregon Dental Hygienist and the Oregon Rural Health Association are the primary proponents, although there are other interested parties. And I wanted to just spend a couple of minutes describing what's in the bill, because there are several issues that are very important, but frankly haven't gotten a lot of discussion, and they're in sections 1 and 2 of the bill. They're not even described in the summary done by Legislative Council, and I just want to point that out to the committee before we go into the other issues about limited access permit hygienists.
Somewhere along the line, talk about the ones and the twos. Whose are those?
I will be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Section 1 of the bill updates the statutes regarding dental hygiene students. Students are now don't have, of course, licenses. They are becoming licensed professionals. They are going to school, yet they have experiences treating patients in clinics as part of their training. The current statute restricts that to full-time bona fide students. And as you might imagine, programs in dental hygiene and other parts of our educational system are now sometimes part-time. And in fact, we also had problems with respect to dental hygiene students before they pass their board exams wanting a refresher course. That's not a full-time student. And we also had concerns about dental hygienists who are licensed in other states other than Oregon coming to our Oregon schools, which are fine programs, and taking continuing education classes and with a clinical component. So Section 1 changes that, and no longer do we have to have bona fide full-time students, but just bona fide students. I don't think there's any controversy in Section 1, but I wanted to point it out as an important issue. I passed out a letter from the Oregon Institute of Technology, which runs one of our fine dental hygiene programs in the state. They're very concerned this part of the bill could be pursued in order to update the statute appropriately. Section 2 is also another sort of cleanup issue, and I'd like to point out that although there's a lot of bold language in Section 2, The only substantive change in Section 2 are the two words "in Oregon" on lines 41 and 42 of page 2. Those words used to be in our statute. In a prior amendment to this statute, they were removed. In the similar statute for dentists, they are included. This issue was frankly discovered during a review of the dental hygiene rules done by the Board of Dentistry last year, and I think this is a commonly agreed necessary technical cleanup to reinsert the words "in Oregon" in Section 2. Then to the major part of the bill in Sections 3 and 4, and I'd like you to refer, if you could, to the Dash 1 amendments, which are our amendments. Sections 3 and 4 deal with the matters that are described in the measure summary. How limited access permits applicants can qualify to obtain their limited access permit in order to practice independently in the community settings that they're permitted to practice in. And once they obtain that permit, what can they do in those settings in terms of performing dental hygiene dental hygiene services. There are the reason you have a Dash 1 amendment is we have had discussions with lots of people about this bill. The concepts in this bill were discussed starting last summer and fall in group meetings in which we invited lots of oral health advocates, and a couple of the members of this committee, in fact, attended those held at the Oregon Health Division building in Portland, where we discussed the need for mid-level providers to be able to provide preventive oral health services in community settings. On that issue, the need to provide better prevention in community settings, I don't think there's any disagreement amongst anyone in the room, at least to my best of my knowledge. And in fact, the bill that you heard a few minutes ago was a perfect setup for this one. The problems are great. We need to do better, and we need to do better in community settings. However, often when people are talking concepts, you don't get down to the specific negotiations until the language of the bill comes out. And when this bill was printed, we entered into a second series of negotiations with lots of advocates interested in the bill. And those people included representatives of both the board and staff from the Oregon Dental Association, the board and the staff from the Board of Dentistry, representatives from the dental hygiene schools, from the Oregon Health Plan Dental Care Organization, and others to discuss the specifics of Section 3 and 4. And from those negotiations, we produced a new Section 3 and 4. And the Dash 1 amendments replace Section 3 and 4. They address how you become a dental hygienist and a new pathway that we've decided to propose for you that I think addresses the very issue that Representative Kotek mentioned. How do we ensure that dental hygienists coming out of our programs who have had some community experience, are eager to work in community settings, can get to that permit and work in those settings, and then also what services they can do. And as part of that...
Oh, you said it says how you get to be a dental hygienist.
No,
you mean
an
LAP. How you get to be a limited access...
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you for correcting my error. You're exactly correct. How you get to be an LAP hygienist having already become a hygienist. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for the error. Ms. Rowley has been part of these discussions and is going to describe the specifics of the proposals in the Dash 1 amendments, but I thought I would close my portion by just talking about why we bring this bill to you and why we think that we need to continue the discussions to reach as many agreements as we can on what is appropriate to move this forward. As I mentioned, I don't think there's any disagreement that prevention in community sites is a necessary additional component to manage our oral health care problems. And there are at least a couple of new reports out that I think highlight this. One is a very good report done by the Oregon Dental Association, published in February 2009 on mid-level providers. And in that report, it said, in part, there are significant expansion of dental access could result from better utilizing both limited access permit dental hygienists, and expanded function dental assistants. We agree with that statement. We think it's well supported by the evidence. And the report went on to say this would seem to be the best way to deliver more care to more individuals at reduced per capita costs. Again, I think the evidence supports that statement. And secondly, your Medicaid Advisory Committee issued a report on oral health just last month in March of 2009 called Oral Health and the Oregon Health Plan. And it included in its recommendations that, quote, establishing alternative care delivery models such as community-based prevention strategies and, quote, establishing school-based prophy dental clinic staffed by an LAP dental hygienist and expanded function dental assistant to practice individualized needs-related preventive oral health services, I love that phrase, was an important way to address the needs of the Oregon Health Plan population. So we think we're all in agreement on the goal, and we would like your careful consideration of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3204, which we think gets us closer to the goal. I believe that the Dash 2 amendments are being proposed by the Oregon Dental Association, so I've let them comment on those.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I might say, as the PowerPoint is coming up, in the context of a picture is worth a thousand words, Dr. Love showed you pictures of some of the kinds of oral health problems we're talking about, but they were probably too small for you to see from your dais. You will see more graphic pictures of the kinds of needs that we're seeing in the community in
Does
this
that mean
presentation.
For every picture up there, you won't say a thousand words?
That's
okay,
correct.
Stay away from that.
Good.
I'm Lisa Raleigh. I'm the program director from the School of Dental Health Science at Pacific University, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3204. And I was going to start with what we know about dental health. I'm sorry, I don't know how to get that little slideshow box off of there, so that's okay. It's fine. Things that we know about dental health, and I'd like to thank the earlier speakers because I think that they alluded to many of these ideas already. But we do know that dental decay and periodontal disease are common preventable diseases. We know that tooth decay and both periodontal disease and tooth decay can lead to additional problems, which are listed on the slide. And we also know that many systemic diseases appear in the mouth first, including diabetes, leukemia, and other disorders, and that early recognition of these diseases leads to earlier, more successful treatment. In the slide, you see a picture of a pulp polyp that would possibly result from an untreated dental decay tooth.
Could we? I mean, because of time, yeah. Could we stipulate the general need for...
Yes, we could skip.
Good dental health.
Perfect.
And move beyond...
Okay. I will move right along then. The other thing that I've included for you is an overview of the dental workforce currently in Oregon. You can see that as of March 2009, we have about 2,700 dental hygienists, 83 LAP dental hygienists, and 2,700 dentists. I've also listed the cost to educate dental professionals. This is a very approximate cost to the institution, about $50,000 for a dental hygienist, about $300,000 for a dentist. And I've also listed the length of their education, dental hygienists 2 to 4 years leading to either an associate a bachelor's degree, dentist 4 years leading to either a DDS or DMD degree. But I think the most compelling thing here is the projected graduates in Oregon for 2009. We are projecting that in dental hygiene we will be graduating 162 dental hygienists this year, and for dental school we'll be graduating 75 dentists. So you can see that we will have more dental hygiene graduates this year, and if you look back to the previous numbers, you'll see that dental hygienists will start to overtake the number of dentists in this state. What is a limited access permit hygienist? Just to review, for over 10 years, we've had the LAP law here in Oregon. LAP dental hygienists provide basic preventive dental health care without dentist supervision. They provide health care in community-based settings so that they can provide their services to underserved patients where they are instead of having the patients come to private dental offices. LAP dental hygienists must refer their patients to a dentist at least once each calendar year. So, therefore, LAP dental hygienists help dentists to expand dental care into community-based settings. But how can we help the LEPs to provide more care to more patients? And that's the purpose of this bill. Three basic things that we need to do. One is to reduce obstacles so that more dental hygienists can obtain a limited access permit. We need to allow limited access permit dental hygienists to provide additional dental hygiene services to the patients they serve. And we need to allow LEP dental hygienists to provide preventive dental health services in collaboration with more health care providers in more locations. So House Bill 3204 does these three basic things. First, I'd like to thank the ODA and the ODHA for inviting me to their meeting so that we could talk about a compromise on this particular portion of the bill. Originally, I believe that the bill had talked about reducing the number of hours, and we've actually come up with an additional pathway. So House Bill 3204 would create an additional pathway for dental hygienists to become an LEP, so it would keep the current LEP requirements but add this additional pathway. This would include a course of study that's approved by the Oregon Board of Dentistry that includes at least 500 hours of dental hygiene practice in limited access settings, requires direct supervision by a faculty member from an accredited program, and allows practice hours before and after graduation to meet the 500-hour requirement. The value of this would be we would be providing training to these LAP dental hygienists in settings where they would actually be working ultimately, so they could find out what it's actually like to be an LAP as opposed to working in a private dental office. And students and new graduates would be more interested in obtaining an LAP permit and providing care in these settings. So this would give them some credit for the fieldwork experience that they've had while they're in hygiene school. The second thing that House Bill 3204 does is it would provide additional, allow LAP dental hygienists to provide additional services to their patients who have limited access to care. And the additional services listed here are dental radiographs, denture soft relines, temporary restorations, and local anesthesia. And just to note that these are procedures that are already performed by dental hygienists in private dental offices under the general supervision of a dentist, which means the dentist does not have to be in the office when the dental hygienist is providing these services. So what we're proposing is to allow LAPs to also provide these services without the supervision of a dentist in community-based settings. The third issue that this bill will take care of is that House Bill 3204 will allow LAP dental hygienists to provide preventive dental health care in collaboration with more health professionals in more locations. And what we're proposing is to allow LAP dental hygienists to provide services to patients that are located in hospitals, medical clinics, medical offices, and then offices staffed by nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and midwives. What we're hoping is that LAP dental hygienists could provide care to these patients in these settings by providing them with dental screenings, educating the patients about their dental needs, and referring medical patients to dentists to receive additional dental treatment. So in summary, we ask that you support House Bill 3204 so that LAP dental hygienists can help dentists to increase access to basic preventive dental care for underserved Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Can we have the lights, please? Are there any questions? We'll hear from a few others and maybe representative questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your work on this. Ms. Hoffman and Dr. Asai.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3204 and the amendments. We have really appreciated sitting down with the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association. In 2007, we sat down with them and came to consensus about the number of hours that would be required for a dental hygienist to obtain a limited access permit. We're happy that we were able to come to consensus this time to provide an alternative path that will allow dental hygienists to obtain a limited access permit, not based on arbitrary requirements, but based on the training that they have to get out into these underserved areas. So we're, there are items in the Dash 1 amendments that we do not support, so we do not support the Dash 1 amendments in their entirety. We offered another amendment that we thought incorporates the alternative pathway, but we're happy to continue to work with the Dental Hygienist Association. They have not agreed to this specific language, so we're happy to work with them to draft Dash 3 amendments that would be our consensus amendment on that. That said, that's the technicality of it, and I will turn the mic to Dr. Asai.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich and the Health Committee. I'm Rick Asai. I'm a dental dentist, practice in the Portland area. And I'm here to represent the views of the Oregon Dental Association. I'm presently president-elect. And as Margie has stated, we are not in support of the bill as written. We'd be glad to, as she's stated, continue to work on that with Oregon Dental Hygiene Association and other interested parties. There are two main components, as you've just heard, about the bill that we have some disagreement about in the way it's written right now, and that is in the qualifications in becoming an LAP hygienist. As you heard summarized by Margie, we had previously negotiated the number of hours that were required to become an LAP down from 5,000 to 2,500 just 2 years ago. In the interim, we thought we were going to have the ability to continue to work on other avenues of access. Certainly, LAP hygienists do provide an additional reach for delivery of preventive services, what you're hearing are already beginning to provide some measurable impact. Excuse me. As we continue to meet with the Oregon Dental Hygiene Association and other interested parties, we do still have a little ways to go in terms of coming to consensus on agreement about final language about these qualifications. I think one of the important points to consider that you may not be aware of is that dental hygiene curriculum, as established by the Council on Dental Accreditation, designs a curricula for the dental hygienist to work as a member of the dental team in a dental office. And Oregon has been very progressive in the development of a limited access permit dental hygienist to work outside of an office. But in the establishment of that permit, the board and the Dental Association and other interested parties at that time, in 1997, I believe it was, realized that there needed to be additional training and experience to be able to work safely outside of a dental office without the supervision of a general dentist or a specialist. And so at that time, the standards were set in place, 5,000 hours of experience, 40 hours of additional coursework, and a couple of little minor, more operational types of things, paperwork. It was presented in 97, the question about the number of hours, and so it seemed reasonable and prudent to try to lower that standard of, in terms of the number of hours. In our recent conversations with the Dental Hygiene Association here in the state and other interested parties, what we came to agreement on was that it was not necessarily based on the number of hours per se, but it really we should be looking at some sort of competency requirement that the ability to work outside of a dental office on their own really should be based on competencies that really haven't been defined or identified. And we feel comfortable that the Board of Dentistry would be able to, with advice and testimony from interested parties, come up with standards that would be able to address that. The second part of the bill that we have concerns about are the areas of expansion of duties. And again, it's related a little bit on what they are trained to do. And certainly they do provide local anesthesia now under general supervision. So what that means is that a dentist has examined and diagnosed the patient's needs and determined that, yes, it may be appropriate to have the dental hygienist use local anesthesia to do some maybe definitive root planing, some deep cleaning to treat some periodontal disease. But they've had the advantage of that additional oversight of the dentist. So perhaps there's a way to have them, again, I think it's important to realize that they're going to be practicing at a slightly higher level outside of an office without the supervision of the dentist. Not to say that they can't technically do some of these things, but I think it's that additional education and training that they need to have. And what that is, I think it's hard to quantify in terms of hours or classes, but I think we're very comfortable that the Board of Dentistry can come to developing those competencies. The Dental Association here in Oregon has also put together a task force beginning last November to begin to look further into this idea of a mid-level provider, and whether it's a more highly trained dental hygienist or someone else who comes into the dental healthcare team, we're still working with that, and we're working on that actively right now, and hope to have some sort of a white paper developed in the next year or so, probably a little bit less than a year. So that's kind of where we're at. As I said, we're opposed to the -1 amendments. We have our -2 amendments. Probably more realistically, we're looking at some -3 amendments to come to some consensus. I'd like to also respond to a few of the items that were just presented in the PowerPoint from our perspective. The first had reference to the numbers of dental hygienists and dentists and LAP hygienists. And while those numbers are true and accurate, the numbers of dental hygienists who are currently eligible to apply for an LAP permit, excepting for the 40 hours of coursework, is probably 80 to 90% of that 2770 number. They've already been out working long enough to get the 2,500 hours. So it's not a very big step to take that extra 40 hours. As far as the education for dental professionals, I think what they've stated is true. What they maybe didn't state, and maybe it's just an error of omission, but for dentists, to enter dental school, you don't go right out of high school. So to say that 4 years to get a dental degree is true, but
8 years.
Usually you have 4 years or whatever. Yeah, thank you. And I think in terms of the number of graduates, certainly there are more dental hygiene programs now in the state, and we do anticipate that they will continue to graduate higher numbers of dental hygienists. And dental hygiene, we love them. I mean, I couldn't practice without them, and the dental hygienists, and certainly LIP hygienists are going to play an increasingly greater role. I think what they do and have the capability to do and are already doing is to provide more prevention, and that's a good balance, I think, to have more people on the preventive side than on the restorative side. In terms of the LIP
dental... Can I ask you to wrap up? We're getting
yeah, this might...
Sorry.
As far as the locations of where LIP hygienists can practice, the board now has the ability to designate those. I don't think we need to legislate that. That's about it. Thank you very much for your time. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, sir. Okay, thank you very
much.
I have a question.
Oh, yes,
Chair. Sorry. Doctor, you and I have talked a little about the dental hygienist as being sort of a pathway for people, an entry point into oral health for immigrants, people of color, and kind of important connectors to their community. Could you say something about that?
Well, I think certainly, in particular, right now we have a few dozen really LIP hygienists that are out working, but certainly there is a lot of activity right now in early Head Start and Head Start programs. The American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry just rolled out April 1st here in Oregon the establishment of a dental home project. So the idea that every child at a very young age, hopefully by age one, is established with a dental home, and that community workers, whether they're LAP hygienists or health care provider, I'm not sure the terminology, the health people in the Head Start programs, have the opportunity to help encourage that establishment of the dental home and follow-up treatment, especially prevention at that age. All of these dental diseases are vastly preventable, and so the earlier we get them in to see them, the better, certainly.
Okay. And Chair Green, like Representative Dembro, I would say it's definitely the trend looking at community further working with community health centers so we can facilitate the relationships and make sure that as, when people are out serving these communities and the people providing preventive care have problems, that we facilitate the relationship to get those people in to get the care that they need and make sure that they receive the care that they need. And that's, another thing that our task force is looking at and will continue to do so over the interim to come back to the 2011 legislature with policy recommendations about how the legislature can move forward to help facilitate these relationships.
How about if we hold that testimony for another 2 years?
That sounds good to me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson, do you have something quick?
Yeah, real quickly.
Move on.
If I read this correctly, the LAP hygienists are like independent practitioners, or do they report to a dentist or work under the relationship with a dentist? Or
That's a very good point. If I had more time, I could go into that, but I think Chair Gleeks maybe got to hold us back. But right now, the statute states that the LAP hygienist needs to refer each patient at least once a year to a dentist for an exam. There's been a breakdown in that referral for exam in the sense that The dental... I'm sorry?
The answer to your question is, within their scope of practice, they practice independently, except that once a year referral, which may or may not be happening.
Yeah, okay.
They have a limited scope of practice,
yeah.
Of practice, but they operate with it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Can we... I'd really like to hold this... I'd like to be done with this session by a quarter to, so if I can ask Lori Kelly and Gary Allen and Karen Phillips, please. And you have written testimony. Submit it. If not, we'll come back again another day.
My name's Lori Kelly, and I'm a hygienist practicing LAP for the last 6 years. I've been a hygienist for 20. I submitted my letter, which will explain all of the things that I've been doing, which are basically all of the things that a limited access permit allows me to do, and the successes I've had with it. And jumping right down to the bottom here is that the last 6 years I've been doing education and training and preventative treatment at the Clackamas County Children's Commission Head Start. And there's some statistics in there about what's been happening and all that type of thing. I co-authored a grant for the Kaiser Foundation, and we were able to get a mobile dental unit for $211,000 for a three-year pilot program. We've been working with other organizations to provide dental sealants and education, Healthy Start, Head Start, the Direct Oregon outreach program. I've been training Head Start staff to provide fluoride treatments. We've had a 90% sign-up rate for parents to get fluoride varnishes. And I feel that that's really basically because I don't talk to the parents directly, that I have been able to train and educate the advocates so that they can educate the families to choose, fortunately, to choose what I feel is the right thing, is to get fluoride varnishes. I think I've covered everything in here. When I do all of this service and work, I actually do hold a Give a Kid a Smile program for over a 2 to 3 month period where Dr. David Doyle out in Clackamas County sees these kids that are the top priority on my list or who do not have access. So I'm not sure how, I think that might answer for my particular how I do the referrals for the kids that I see. But I think that we like to work as a team. Dr. Ashi helped give me my first grant for Head Start, the Oregon Dental Foundation, and thank you. And they do work with us nicely, so I really appreciate it, and it's been a privilege to work with these kids. It brings joy to my heart, and I get hugs every day. So thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Allen?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity, and for the record, I'm Gary Allen. I am an Oregon dentist, and I'm also a dental consultant to Willamette Dental, and I'm here today representing both myself as a dentist and Willamette Dental. And I'd like to begin by stating that we support House Bill 3204 as a cost-effective and efficient way to expand services to the most needy populations in our state. And I've submitted written testimony outlining our position as an organization. In the interest of time, I'm going to abbreviate my comments and just skip to, I think, a point of the bill that I think bears some additional discussion or needs some additional discussion. First, I'd like to point out that I've seen Ms. Kelly's program in Clackamas County, and she's much too modest. I wish there was more time for her to go into the details of what she does there. As a representative of the LAP hygienists and what they're doing in a couple of communities throughout the state. Another one that I would cite and welcome if you ever have the opportunity would be to go into Lane County and see a similar program there. And the value that an LAP hygienist is doing by providing preventive services as well as screening exams and triage and prioritization of care on these communities to assist with the dental access problem. And I would ask you to imagine that if the program that she has in Clackamas County and the program that is in Lane County and some other examples throughout the state, if every community and every county had similar programs, what a difference it would make. And also imagine how much more effective Ms. Kelly could be and other LAP hygienists if they were trained and allowed to do simple temporary restorations when they encounter frank, obvious dental decay in the populations that they see. And I'd like to take a moment just to discuss that because I think that it maybe in some cases is projected as being far more sophisticated than it really is. Removal of superficial decay and application of a temporary glass ionomer, and that's just a filling material, temporary filling material. It's a technique that's widely practiced throughout the world. And you may have heard it referred to as ART or A, traumatic restorative treatment, or interim therapeutic restoration, or probably more commonly, and the best descriptive term is scoop and fill, as it's been referred to by various groups. It's a proven technique. It's supported by several clinical studies. It's been endorsed by the World Health Organization, and it's been used for years to bring basic dental care to underserved populations in remote locations. It's been proven to be cost-effective, carries minimal risk, does not require anesthesia or sophisticated equipment, and can be done by non-dentist providers after
Dr.
some
Allen,
additional training. Yes.
Can I hold this particular issue? I'm going to ask both Mr. Cosgrave and Ms. Hoffman to get together and come up with an agreed-upon bill if they can. If
okay.
they can't, I think this is likely to be the nexus of the disagreement, and then when we get it back, we'll have some serious discussion about this so we can hear it from both sides. Huh?
I think my written testimony or comments
covers it, well.
Covers
yeah.
it very well.
I mean, this could end up being a serious issue, and if so, I want to make sure we have the time to address it, and I will make the time to address it.
I understand. That's why I wanted to get a little something in there anyway.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Dr. Shortcliffe, I think you've come the furthest to testify today. Can I ask you to join us? And Mr. Bratz, you're on deck, so why don't you come on up? You can be the cleanup hitter and tell us all about it from the perspective of the board. Thank you for coming, Dr. Shortcliffe.
Thank you for. I actually did drive, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I actually did drive through a snowstorm this morning on the way over from Redmond. It was 27 degrees. The snow was blowing. Poor visibility, and I didn't have any studded tires or chains, and so I was because those times have passed. So I appreciate
above and beyond.
I appreciate your indulgence. I come over a lot, but to get here when you're testifying on sometimes is difficult to do. So I appreciate the opportunity. I'm not against the bill. In fact, I'm for it. But what I'm against is the training requirements that I appreciate this, Representative Greenlink, you brought up about. You know, I practiced in Myrtle Creek for 20 years. I helped 300 dentists put a program together so we could take care of 55,000 rural Oregonians so we could have access to care. And I have dropped the spoon excavator in taking out that superficial decay into the bottom of a pulp of the nerve of the tooth, wishing that I'd had a root canal, started a root canal. So it's not as innocuous as they think it to be. So I won't get into that debate because I take the other side. I think there are a lot of things we can do not to expand the scope past where it needs to be. I put a question mark on my testimony because I'm for the concept, I'm for the expansion, but I'm not for the training requirements. You know, when I just looked up the training requirements for a physician's assistant and also looked up the requirements for a nurse practitioner. And some of the things that we're asking for the dental hygienist to do would require a lot of training that I think we need to address. I'm for letting the Board of Dentistry, having a lot of us get out of the business of telling them what to do and allow them to come up with requirements that I think would meet addressing this issue. The other thing I wanted to touch upon is I hope that we never, ever use the underserved and guilt as a reason to do legislation like this. I have practiced on the underserved since 1991, when I decided to give up practice making perfect margins and take care of 3,700 kids in rural Douglas County because nobody else would. So let's don't use that as a reason, because this is not a shortage of workforce issues. This is a misallocation of workforce. It's a misallocation of rules, like Representative Maurer so aptly put when we started. This is a change in the rules for the culture that we're in today, and I think we ought to do that methodically, thoughtfully, and in a way that allows us to serve the public so that they're not harmed and they get access to the appropriate care they need. And by the way, you heard some previous testimony earlier about fluoride and stuff. You might want to get the experts in and really review that subject. For example, if you really want to, in rural Oregon, have the most effective cost way to for prevention of fluoride, send toothpastes and fluoride toothbrushes and fluoride toothpaste to people on a random basis. They did that in England, and they reduced the tooth decay by 20 to 50%. They send it every 90 days. So, as a sidelight in rural Oregon, there's some things we can do. But the last thing I wanted to say is I don't see any place in the bill where it mandates LAPs to practice in places like Myrtle Creek. I mean, we had there's no place in the bill where it mandates that we'll do this and people will show up in places that I have to practice, which is Wallowa, Enterprise, Burns, Lakeview, Myrtle Creek, Sutherland, Gold Beach, all kinds of places where I don't suspect that these folks will actually go to when they're trained. And so that's a piece that I want us to remember. Just because we pass the legislation doesn't mean the workplace is going to follow where it needs to in those worlds and the rurals. Because there are a lot of other issues that you guys have addressed in this committee that address that. So, anyway, I'm for the bill.
We've actually noticed that last point.
So. I know, And very frankly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm for the bill. I just think that there are some issues that have been pointed out that we need to address before we go forth to make it the best bill possible. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any comments? We would try and get a couple of those folks to ride with you when you're going from Myrtle Creek to to Wallowa.
There you go.
Thank you. Final word on this, yes. Mr. Bratz.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Patrick Bratz.
As I guess people have been testifying, you should have the
I
final
guess.
Word.
Representative Board of Dentistry. Just two brief points. The board originally looked at this bill on March 20th without the dash ones and dash twos, obviously. Their motion was that they were willing to sit down and work with the Dental Hygiene Association and the Dental Association to come up with some language that would be acceptable to the parties, and actually we were a party to that recent meeting, as were a couple members of the board. I actually have a concern about Section 2 of the bill, and that's what I've passed out for you. If you look at line 37...
Section 2 of the original
bill. Of the original bill. If you look at line 37, sub 4, as Mr. Cosgrove stated earlier, and he is correct, when some legislation was fixed about 2 years ago, for some reason the words "in Oregon" were removed from the area dealing with dental hygiene. Now, it wasn't done on purpose. It was done by some kind of a fluke. That's what needs to be inserted back into that language. And as you see here, I've given you a copy of what sticking in Oregon would do. This language that's now been put in, which has not been done necessarily by Mr. Cosgrove or the ODHA, has been done by LC, doesn't make any sense to us. I've had the Attorney General, our Assistant Attorney General, review it today. She's talked with LC. They can't agree on what this means, and that causes a problem for me as the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry, because I'm going to be the one that has to help enforce it with the board. They're saying, you know, it has to be brought up to standards of grammatics and other such thing. It's just very simple. Put back in the words "in Oregon." It'll read the same as the dentist statute, which you see below. But putting this in, it almost looks like the individuals wouldn't have to take an examination. And that would pose a very serious problem for us. So we have some concerns about this. I wasn't actually able to speak to LC, our Assistant Attorney General was, but that's a concern we have, because I don't think you want to do something that causes a problem instead of fixing a problem. So.
Yeah, you can bet on that. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I would like... I'd like Mr. Bratz in the middle of that discussion as well, and if I could get the ODA representatives and dental hygiene representatives together, if it's possible to get a dash three that you agree on in the next few days, very few days, I would really appreciate that. If not, we'll put two alternative versions in front and see if we can fight it out, but it would be much better, and that might we might not be able to get that if we do it that way. it would be much better if you could get a dash three that you agree on that compromises it. And you can have another shot at fighting at it in the Senate. But it would be very useful if we had agreement on something, if that's at all possible. Okay? Any other comments from anybody here? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3204 and open up a work session on House Bill 2009 for the purpose of talking about some amendments. We're going to work a bunch of amendments tomorrow, but Representative Maurer has given us about 30, I think, or some number like that, and we might even work one or two of them. But he's asked for an opportunity to introduce what it is we have in front of us so we can...
That's the whole stack. That's a stack.
This is one stack. Okay.
That's one stack. Here's another stack.
We also have copies over there.
Oh, you do have them?
There are some more copies there, yes.
We, no.
We take care of our members.
I thought we didn't have
one. Everything appears
on okay.
me.
No, you need one, right?
I've got one.
You've got one.
Yeah.
Here's another stack. Keep them together. It's the whole pile. Are they multiple copies of the same one?
No, they're not multiple copies
of
the same
one. Notice the numbers.
They look like that.
Multiple copies of the same thing.
Yeah, these look like they're all the same.
Those stash
How's the stack?
Yeah, but there's multiple limits in each.
Ah, but it's not the whole stack. It's just
starting with 11?
One per person.
All right, I got it. I thought it was the whole pile.
I'm sorry.
One per person. How many more do we need?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We have all of them
that you want. Right. Why does he have a mouth? I didn't know you had that.
What should we have?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go ahead and start while people are...
Please.
On one stack, on the top is the Dash 11 amendment to House Bill 2009. And
Dash 11.
Which is would be the other pile, Mr. Chair. You gave away the pile.
All right. There were two different piles, right?
And then there's another copy.
One says amendments on the top.
Dash 11.
And the other says the Dash 11. Do you have those?
The Dash 11.
We have some of these.
And you have one that looks like this. Okay.
What? How did you end up with all of these?
You gave them to me.
So should we take one of each of these?
These you should take one of each, and so everybody should have one that says amendments to HB 209A, and the other one says the dash 11. And when it says dash 11, there are more of them behind.
Those two are for you. I don't know what happened to the other.
He's selling them outside on Court Street.
Do you have one of, the first ones that's intact? Because these staples are all coming apart, and we don't know where they're supposed to be.
Well, you know what? We're going to focus on just a very couple amendments. 2011, I think, Representative Harper's on the very top.
Dash 11.
Yeah,
dash
11. And to ask what the last page of this is the dash 14. So
right.
If you don't have a dash 14, you don't have the whole file.
What's the dash 19?
Dash 19?
I've got a
33.
Yeah, there's
14,
19. I'm just talking about the very last page of the one that starts with the dash 11. The very last page, I think, is a dash 14.
I've got a 33.
I've got a 33 after that.
That's
I've got
right.
A 33.
That's, okay. We're only going to let's deal with the dash 11.
Okay.
The dash 11 is language that came out of Senate Bill 329 that has to do with evaluating the work, in this case, not of the Health Fund Board, of the Oregon Health Authority. And this assessment would be required every other year, and it would be an evaluation to the governor and a legislative assembly, and it addresses various issues such as access to care, access to health insurance coverage, quality care, et cetera, health outcomes, health disparities, financial impacts. And so it is a formal process that the Oregon Health Authority would have to go through to evaluate itself and how it is doing on various areas.
And it's my intention to hear this tomorrow night, maybe to kick off things, and if you have the votes to pass it.
Okay. So the Dash 11 is going to be heard. The next one, right below it, is the Dash 12. The dash 12 restores language to the current formula for establishing net revenue. In this bill, the engrossed version of House Bill 2009, if you look at page 20, the word bad debt has been eliminated. And what that translates to is that hospital or that money the hospital never received would be taxed.
That's page 36 of the dash 2s, was it? Do we have an idea of where it is in the...
It is, page 20, right here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Page 20, line 14.
Uh-huh.
And that is of serious concern to me, that because that is changing the formula for how they calculate net revenue. And I'm not sure how we tax people on money they never got.
You're saying current law exempts bad debt, and this change would no longer exempt it?
Current law defines net revenue as charges minus charity care.
We'll check on that one by tomorrow night.
Mr. Chair, sort of a process question on this. This is related to the provider tax, right?
This is related to the provider tax, which will either be in this bill or in 2116. So we do need to know this. And what this is really a crazy way. Theoretically, the tax is intended to go on net health care revenue. So rather than going for net health care revenue, because when the provider tax was implemented, there wasn't an easy way to get it. It takes total charges and subtracts things that aren't collected. Well, it's actually total charges minus contractual arrangements, minus a discount for contractual arrangements, minus bad debt, and minus charity. So the language here is intended to be exactly as it is in the current bill, so in the current statute. So we'll find the current statutes and make sure it's in here in exactly the form we have agreed not to change this at all. So
right. If
this misses it, we'll know by tomorrow, and we'll have an amendment to put it back the way it is in the current statutes. That is the intention.
And the last, of course, I think all of these have merit. All of these amendments have merit, but the chair has said that we are not going to discuss all of them. The other one is the dash 40, which is page 3. It's right underneath. And that it, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a referral one, it looks like, huh?
Well, that's... Yes, that is the referral amendment. Essentially...
Actually, it's not. I mean, well, it goes into the terms as well.
I'm not quite sure why it goes into the terms, but if you turn a page over, section 1165...
I don't have that.
I don't have the back side.
We don't have the back.
Okay, well... All I will say that is the referral to the voters. It's an amendment that would send House Bill 2009 to the voters. And so that one I would like to at least have considered.
And that would be whether or not there's a tax...
It just says the next general election.
And that would be whether or not there's a tax in it, you would still suggest referring to the voters?
Well, Mr. Chair... I'm looking at a bill that is both policy and tax. That's what I need to deal with.
Yeah, no, but I'm asking. I mean, one of the options, and it seems relatively likely to me that the decision, not my decision, because I prefer not, but the decision will be to move the expansion and the tax to 2116. So my question is, and this is a policy question, and you don't have to answer it tonight, but would you still be wanting to move this, referring to the voters, if the tax and the expansion is not in it?
Well, I believe that this policy is such a substantial change in the way we address health care in the state of Oregon, that in fact this is a policy question that does in fact need voter input. And
okay, I hear you.
So.
Okay. Is there anything else in this that you want to note in discussing where we are?
No, there's lots
many,
of...
Many of these, the reason that Representative Maurer and I have talked is because many of these basically invalidate policy discussions, policy issues that I think we're putting in. So they simply say, don't do X, do Y. My intention is to, at least now, I mean, we'll hear anything that you propose because we have to, but mm-hmm. we propose not doing something that doesn't have a...
Actually, no, you don't, Mr. Chair. You don't have to hear it. You can gavel me down. That has not been your modus operandi.
No, I will not gavel you down. I will simply not have discussion, take a vote. And
okay.
But I think I definitely will move the 11th. I think the 11th makes sense for discussion here. I mean, we'll accept it. And if there are others that you particularly want to make sure we have some discussion on, bring them in. Okay? I mean, we have them. We will acknowledge now, in fact, the extent to which it needs to be acknowledged, that Representative Maurer has presented dash 11 through 23 and dash 26 through 42. Is that your record as well?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. They are acknowledged.
And those are, Mr. Chair, those are my amendments. Those are a caucus amendment. Those members of my caucus have not necessarily seen these. In fact, I presented those, essentially presented them to you earlier.
All right. Appreciate the list. Yes. We'll also, one of the things that we'll do tomorrow night is we're going to really get seriously into some of these amendments. I think we have a couple of other things, but we have 3 hours tomorrow. Is I want to propose, if we have them tomorrow, I think we do the four Senate bills. We think we will have amendments that were the four bills passed by the Senate Health Committee to Ways and Means. And a couple of hours ago, I probably would have remembered which they are, but I know the Pulse is one of them. One of them is, I think, all payer, all claims. One is electronic medical records, I think. And the other one is, I think, a manpower thing. Is that right? Yeah, I think those are the four. A healthcare resources one, or a Hugh person power, if you want, whichever. Okay. Thank you all. Thank you all for testifying. I think we've had a very productive meeting. Maybe we can get some more stuff out of here on Wednesday, or maybe tomorrow even. I do want to alert you. We're going to have a hearing on HJR 18 tomorrow night. My hope would be to move that with a due pass recommendation to the Rules Committee, where it will rest, curing itself over the next few weeks, is my assumption. That's just forewarning.
Mr. Chair, we're scheduled until 9 tomorrow night.
We're going 6 to 9 tomorrow night. Yeah, that's our hope. Bring lots of cabinets.
Thank you.